to go. All right, so I will officially call cause 03-17-506, Glenn Hager and Ken Paxton versus EBS Solutions. And Ms. Andrews, you're here on behalf of the appellant, correct?
I am, Your Honor, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very good. You may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The district court erred in denying the state's plea to the jurisdiction because EBS Solutions failed to comply with the statutory requirement that it prepay all the taxes before bringing suit in order to comply with the waiver of sovereign immunity. I'd like to raise four primary points. EBS's partial payment is not sufficient to constitute prepayment of the taxes at issue. Second, its oath of inability to pay cannot excuse it from the prepayment requirements. Third, neither this court nor the Texas Supreme Court has previously invalidated those prepayment requirements. And finally, whether the prepayment requirements violate the open courts doctrine is not for this court to rule upon for the first time in this matter. So first, regarding the partial payment, ABS paid approximately $150,000 of the $250,000 that were owed to the state. It then filed suit under sections 112.051 and 112.101, which both say that prior to filing suit, a taxpayer must have paid all the taxes, fees, and penalties then due or posted.
If we could jump off into something else, I think we're all somewhat familiar with our communications, which clearly indicated that one's access to the courts could not be impeded because of financial considerations. And so the provision that conditioned injunctive action, declaratory action on payment of the taxes owed or posting of bonds, that provision was stricken, right? And
that's
did the court not say at that time, since taxpayers had the ability to utilize a deck action prior to the implementation of this provision, striking that will kick us back into that territory where one can bring a deck action without finances interfering?
That's correct, Your Honor. And
okay, so what really then is the effect? I mean, we all know, yeah, in the first instance, if you want to pay your taxes, you can bring your suit. If you want to post your bond, you can bring your suit. But the backdrop here is our communications that says one who is unable to pay cannot be denied access to the courts. So, and if that was recognized as sort of a common law principle there, what does it really matter that 108 is no longer in existence?
Well, 108 is what the court struck in our communications, and then the legislature tried to amend, and this court again struck in Bandag.
Right.
So it's gone. 108 was the statute that banned declaratory relief. And in our communications, the court found that by getting rid of 108 and allowing a taxpayer to have the alternative to come in with a UDJA claim to assert the unconstitutionality of a statute, that by doing that, they had cleared up the constitutional infirmity regarding the prepayment requirements in general. So now a taxpayer is back to where they were before our communications, which means you have two tracks. You can come in under 112, comply with the prepayment requirements, get review of your tax liability, your tax assessment, or you can bring a UDJA claim, but it still has to comply with the UDJA. It still has to be a proper claim under that line of cases and that.
And that being what?
City of El Paso versus Heinrich.
But I mean the type of claim that you're saying would be proper utilizing UDJA.
That would be one asserting the unconstitutionality of a statute or the an ultra-virus action.
Okay.
And this court recently dealt with that in Hager versus Paxi, and said that it can't just be any UDJA claim. It does have to be a properly filed UDJA claim that would stand under the UDJA. But the court in our communications held that by giving that right, that was sufficient to give taxpayers a way into court. Before our communications was decided, the Supreme Court had already decided Texas Association of Businesses versus Texas Air Control Board, which ruled on the open courts doctrine and held kind of what the analysis was for when a statute violates the open courts doctrine. And then they ruled, so they had that available to them, and they decided in our communications that by getting rid of the ban on declaratory relief, they were allowing a way for people to come in and to bring a claim regarding the constitutionality of a statute, or to, by some egregious act by the comptroller, an ultra-virus act, they could still come in and assert that. But they didn't intend to blow a giant hole in sovereign immunity and allow anyone into court who wanted to come in. They made clear that this is only a claim for declaratory relief that would otherwise stand.
And are you saying here that the issue with the a constitutional challenge to the prepayment requirement in the subchapter A would have to be brought as a UDJA claim here? Is that what you're arguing?
It would at least have to be brought before the the trial court. The only way it was raised here at all was in response to our plea to the jurisdiction, EBS raised, basically stated that these provisions have already been stricken.
Are essentially, they're raising the constitutional concerns, the open courts concerns, as a defense to the enforcement of the prepayment requirement.
If they had done that properly, that might be able to bring it before the court. There's some case law in State v. Scott. The Texas Supreme Court did say that our system of litigation is by petition and answer, and the constitutionality of a statute needs to be raised in one of those. The law is not completely 100% clear on how you can bring it, but the way it was raised here, initially in EBS's petition, they didn't mention the open courts doctrine at all. They filed an oath of inability to pay. They said, we're not prepaying, but here's our oath of inability to pay, which would be sufficient under 108, but 108 is gone, so we can't rely on it, they can't rely on it, 108's no more. So we filed a plea to the jurisdiction saying this oath of inability to pay is not sufficient, and in that response they said, okay, but the courts have already stricken the prepayment requirements. And so at that point we argued in the hearing, which was the day after that response was filed, that no, actually, that's not what our communications or Bandag or Richmond said, but never was there an actual claim filed saying, strike this statute as unconstitutional, it violates the open courts doctrine.
Well, they are saying, you can't enforce this against us. They're saying it's unenforceable, we can go ahead, leave us alone.
Right, in their response to the plea to the jurisdiction. Yeah. But yes, it should have been brought in their petition. They could have brought it as a UDJA claim. That would have been a way to get it properly before the court. Under the open courts analysis, the state has to prove that there is a legitimate state interest once they've proven that there is a restriction on access to courts, which there's not here, by the way. The statutes that we're talking about are waivers of sovereign immunity. They're giving people ways into court that they didn't previously have.
Can we back you up kind of big picture? If we didn't have 112 here, the remedies for litigating taxation, I mean, is there no remedy for a taxpayer if the state imposes some tax that you think is illegal? I mean, isn't there like a takings backdrop to all this? You've got a constitutional concern in the background.
Right.
There's some 1890 cases, I think, that deal with that. Like if we don't have 112, where are we?
Well, if we don't
I'm just wondering why we're talking about sovereign immunity. I mean, it seems like there's some piece of this that may not implicate sovereign immunity.
This case absolutely does implicate sovereign immunity. A case for review of your tax liability does implicate sovereign immunity. And our communications and all of those cases, Nestle, in Ray Nestle, the Supreme Court said that you're limited to the 112 actions.
That is the exclusive remedy idea, right? Now that the legislature's created this, this is the route you have to go.
That's right, Your Honor. And the UDJA is there and would provide a means for someone to raise, and if the comptroller did do something illegal or or a statute did violate the Constitution or something truly egregious like that, the UDJA would likely provide a means for someone to get into court.
By the way, I think this is a very unique posture or context for the AG to be over here arguing for a parallel, standalone, ancillary UDJA action standing beside some kind of administrative proceeding. Usually it's the other way. Y'all are pretty emphatic the other way.
Well, and we did in BANDAG and our communications, we did try to assert that 108 doesn't let you have that UDJA claim, but we lost. Well, so here we are.
Counsel, following up on my colleague's comment, just for a taxpayer who's challenging a tax assessment, this isn't a constitutional claim, just challenging the tax assessment, and they can't prepay the tax under protest, is there any avenue, any mechanism, any manner, means, or way, even through the common law, that they can file suit and jurisdiction will attach?
There is not, Your Honor. Okay. Unfortunately, sovereign immunity is harsh. It prevents that. They do have a remedy to...
And your authority for that is our communications, BANDAG, and the statutory language remaining intact.
Nestle as well, although Nestle did...
Nestle glossed over it in a footnote.
Right. Nestle did rely somewhat on 108, talking about it being the exclusive remedies, but without 108, sovereign immunity prevents it. Sovereign immunity prevents any suit against the state that isn't in compliance with some form of statutory waiver of sovereign immunity. There are a few other cases, State v. Lewick, several other cases that have ruled that any kind of action is barred unless there's strict compliance with the statutory waiver of sovereign immunity. Prairie View A&M versus CHOPPA, numerous other cases that have ruled that. So here we are. You have to comply with 112, or if you can bring a proper UDJA claim or an APA challenge or something along those lines that fits under one of those statutes, then you can bring that claim. But as far as review of your tax liability and trying to unwind what the taxpayer has done, your option is to bring suit under Chapter 112, and you have to comply with those provisions.
But the proper UDJA claim doesn't get the taxpayer out of paying on the front end, correct?
Yes, a proper UDJA claim would get them out of paying. There's no prepayment requirement that I'm aware of.
Provided that it's the statute itself that's being attacked.
Right, right. As long as it would be a proper UDJA claim, they can come in. But they can't just call something a UDJA claim that's actually a Chapter 112 claim, because there's still that line of cases, the City of El Paso versus Heinrich, the Department of Transportation versus CEFSIC, Ex Parte Springsteen, various cases ruling what is and is not allowed under the UDJA, and we can't ignore all of that and say, well, this is, you know, our communication said they needed another way into court, so they can just, you know, shoehorn something into the UDJA. This entire scheme that the plaintiffs are arguing for here, and I say plaintiffs because there are numerous cases where this is coming up. We've recently had Paxi and Farshid and Synadco and a few other cases, and everybody's coming up with some different scheme to try to get into court. This doesn't give taxpayers any kind of notice of what is required of them. It's not a workable system. It doesn't give the courts notice of what's jurisdictionally okay. Chapter 112 lays out certain statutory requirements. This court's case law, the Supreme Court's case law say, yes, you can also bring a UDJA claim, but you have to comply with those provisions. Those are the ways into court.
So only an independently otherwise proper UDJA claim will fly here. But isn't a limitation on the use of the UDJA where the legislature has created an exclusive remedy or an issue and presented in the UDJA claim is already teed up in another proceeding, which here would be the defense to the enforcement of the prepayment requirement in the administrative proceeding, wouldn't it? It seems like we're potentially into a circularity here.
I'm sorry.
If you're saying only an otherwise jurisdictionally proper UDJA claim can work, and you've mentioned that it has to be a challenge to a statute if you're suing the state, but aren't you back into the morass of redundant remedies? We've got the rule against using UDJA just as a vehicle. Of course, I guess fees aren't a question now, but
that is.
If they're fighting the application or enforcement of the prepayment requirement in the challenge, the subchapter 8 proceeding, how can you use the UDJA here is what I'm trying to figure out. How's that
it
otherwise
seems to
proper
me that,
UDJA claim?
Well, it seems to me that if a proper UDJA claim had been brought challenging the constitutionality of the prepayment requirements in this case, then we could...
Y'all wouldn't go shouting, well, you've already got that teed up in the other proceeding. You can't do this. I mean, that's the argument we normally hear.
Here we don't have another proceeding.
Aren't they trying to bring a... isn't the posture the principal posture an attempt to challenge the basically the litigate a protest, right?
Yes.
We've got that. I'm saying the primary proceeding. That's what I'm trying to talk about.
Right. I'm sorry. Yes, that is the only proceeding we have. Is they're trying to challenge their protest.
And you're saying they've got to bring a different one under the UDJA, or one parallel, or a different claim in the same suit, right?
Right. A different claim in the same suit would have worked likely. I don't want to try to tie anyone's hands once one was brought, as far as what arguments would be made. Right. But yes, if a claim had been brought in the petition saying we're not complying with the prepayment requirements because they violate the open courts doctrine, mm-hmm. and therefore we'd like the court to rule that we don't have to comply with the prepayment requirements because they do violate the open courts doctrine, then we would have a case. We would have an issue to discuss whether they do violate the open courts doctrine, but that's not what happened here. They just said, here's our oath of inability to pay, we're not prepaying, and we shouldn't be liable for franchise taxes for these various reasons. The open courts never even entered the picture until the response to our plea to the jurisdiction filed the day before the hearing that was basically just saying the court's already stricken it. They've never asked the trial court or this court to rule. Well, they have actually in their reply brief seem to have asked the court to rule that it violates the open courts doctrine for the first time, but they did not tee that up for the trial court. We need an opportunity to present the legitimate state interest in this statute, to present evidence regarding why the prepayment requirements are necessary to protect the state fisc, to allow the comptroller to predict what type of funds will be available for the state to run in the coming years. None of that was before the court because the open courts issue was not raised properly at that point.
Okay. At a bare minimum, y'all need another shot in the trial court to litigate the open courts issue.
At a bare minimum, I believe that would be bringing a claim that they haven't already brought.
Say the hypothetical claim that they did not bring from your standpoint.
Right, Your Honor. Thank you. And right, but the plea, so far it has not been ruled, and the court did rule in our communications that by striking 108 they had sufficiently dealt with the open court's problem. So we think it's before this court now to grant the plea to the jurisdiction and dismiss the case entirely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Andrews. Now, help me here. Is Trafigan?
Trapagan, Your Honor. Trapagan.
Trapagan. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And may it please the court. The trial court properly denied the state's plea to the jurisdiction because EBS complied with all valid requirements of Chapter 112. The one requirement with which EBS did not comply, the prepayment requirement, it violates the open courts doctrine of the Texas Constitution.
But is it not gone and has been gone and essentially never was? It's been stricken.
The prepayment requirement
is not
there. We've complied with everything that's still there, and this court has never ruled that.
What do you mean you've complied with everything that's still there?
We filed a protest letter. We filed a statement of grounds with the Attorney General for the injunction. We properly pled a protest suit, an injunction suit, all of those requirements. The only thing we didn't do is pay the full amount of tax due, and that requirement is unconstitutional. So we are properly before the court for a protest and injunction suit.
Now, she says you waived the open courts argument. I was trying to follow it. Procedurally, when did y'all tee that up?
When we initially filed suit, we did file an oath of inability to pay. There was some uncertainty because in the Nestle suit, the Texas Supreme Court noted that it's dicta that the oath of inability to pay was still alive. So we weren't sure exactly how to do that. When they filed the...
So you did file an inability to pay up the front.
And we did also had a hearing on that, and upon notice and hearing, it was found that requiring us to prepay by the trial court... The trial court found that requiring us to prepay would violate open courts. So we met all those the requirements of 108 if that requirement exists.
Which kind of tracks the open courts analysis, doesn't it?
Yes.
When you talk about unreasonably restrict your access to the court, it's
yes.
kind of the same
yes.
stuff, isn't it?
Yes, that was in our oath of inability to pay, and that's we okay. had a hearing on that.
But the question then remains, does that apply in the context of a suit against the state, and more specifically, in a suit against the state challenging assessment or collection of taxes? What is your authority there?
What is our authority that... our authority is our
procedure that you've attempted to implement here succeeds in getting you into a viable lawsuit against the state. Where and how is the state's immunity waived here?
I feel like that sovereign immunity that the courts have set out and something separate from sovereign immunity. They've said that even in cases of purely statutory causes of action, where the legislature is allowing the government to be sued, that these particular financial restrictions implicate the Constitution. If you look at the Texas Association of Business case, that case sets out three different requirements of open courts, and only one of those applies to purely statutory causes of action, and that is that there will be no unreasonable financial restrictions. Mm-hmm. All of these lines of cases, while they don't directly say the words sovereign immunity, all involve the government being sued. Mm-hmm. That the Texas Association of Business case involved the government requiring a prepayment of environmental penalties in order to be sued. You have our communications, which we're all very familiar with. You have Central Appraisal District versus Lal, which dealt with the issue of requiring a prepayment of property taxes. And we have numerous cases where the Texas Supreme Court and this court have set out financial restrictions as something different. They're saying, you know, the state is saying they can set any restriction they want on their being sued. Now, if the legislature passed a statute that said in order to challenge a tax assessment in court, you must pay $1 million. No, just that doesn't pass the smell test. That doesn't, you know, that saying that only people who can afford it can go into court. As the court said in both Texas Association of Business and in Law, the guarantee of constitutional rights shall not depend on the balance in one's bank account. These financial restrictions are a special circumstance. When the state's talking about other cases where the court has found found a lack of jurisdiction, like Farshid and Sinatco, those taxpayers didn't just fail to comply with the prepayment requirement. They failed to comply with notice requirements. And Nestle was the same thing. And that's entirely reasonable because that doesn't raise the constitutional, you know, peril that requiring prepayment does without a good legislative purpose.
And so in essence, once you've got a statutory waiver of immunity, there can't be unreasonable. There's a constitutional right that kicks in at that point.
Yeah, you can't say that.
In essence, it's almost like an equal protection almost idea. You can't keep some people out if they can't afford it.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor. Exactly.
Now, one thing I raised with your colleague earlier, I mean, is there some takings backdrop to all this that maybe informs how we should view these issues? Because, you know, sovereign immunity doesn't bar claims against, at least injunctively, against unconstitutional actions. Does that aid us at all here, or is that just...
I mean, I think so. Certainly, requiring somebody to pay in order to not have their property taken away would seem to just implicate...
Kind of intuitively. Yeah.
I don't currently have any specific authority on that.
Yeah.
I could, if you would require additional briefing, I could present.
Well, if you got something, I don't think anybody would object. Of course, your colleague gets to respond to anything you file.
Okay.
Just wondered. I guess what piqued my interest is that if you dig, R. Sharp cites some cases that go back to the 1890s. I happen to glance at those, and it seems like that was, that's a what's now Chapter 12, 112 proceeding. I think the issue with the constitutional issue was being raised, or the validity of the taxes were being raised in the context of maybe the state trying to execute on property, and no one's talking about sovereign immunity there, and I think they were talking about takings, as I recall. That's kind of where it's coming from.
Well, and I think something we have to be very keenly aware of is right, wrong, or indifferent, the whole concept of sovereign immunity has permeated everything we do, and it has been developed primarily by the Texas Supreme Court to a degree that the obvious starting point has to be almost in every single case, if immunity has not been waived, affirmatively waived, clearly and unambiguously waived by the legislature, a suit against the state cannot proceed. And again, I say right, wrong, or indifferent, that's the fact of the matter. So I'm not sure many of these older cases where that issue was never raised, much less litigated, particularly once we see the extent to which it has been analyzed and reanalyzed and analyzed again, and doctrines set forth by the Supreme Court, just a general idea that, well, you can't impede access to the courts due to finances, even against the state, I'm not sure that gets us over the hurdle that has now been erected with the recent sovereign immunity law.
Yeah, to be more precise doctrinally, it would be an issue going to the application or whether sovereign immunity is implicated in the first instance as opposed to, you know, the parameters of the starting point, the doctrine, how broad or narrow sovereign immunity is, and whether it's implicated by a particular set of claims as opposed to the waiver per se.
I understand it raises a pretty grave concern, and it's rather unfortunate that the legislature has sort of left us with this quandary. Despite this Section 108 being invalidated in multiple versions, the legislature has seemed to have not provided us any guidance. So our communications in all of those cases, and recently up into, you know, most recently in this court, Justice Perrier's decision in Richmond Aviation that he wrote, we have all allowed, recognized that there has to be an allowance for a taxpayer to challenge a tax assessment without paying. And it would, of course, be a lot less thorny if the legislature had stepped in as one would expect them to, and what seems to be their purpose in this, the whole, you know, checks and balances of all of this, to clearly delineate a manner in which the state can be sued in this circumstance without someone having to prepay.
And what is your, given the status of the cases and how jumbled up this is, given what we have to work with, what is the proper procedure for a taxpayer to challenge a tax assessment?
As opposed to a statute.
Challenge a tax assessment and where they are unable to pay.
I believe that what happened in Richmond Aviation, which was a fairly recent case that, like I said, was written by Justice Perrier, that involved basically an identical circumstance to this. A taxpayer brought an injunction suit under Chapter 112, and they met all of the requirements of Chapter 112, except that they did not prepay. And in that case, it was permitted, the injunction suit was permitted to go forward and follow the injunction procedures. And the injunction procedures are still rather steep, and there are a lot of
a little more nuanced than that, didn't we say that because the trial court had based its rulings on 108, that the case had to go back to the trial court because there was no 108 for the court to base its ruling on?
And that's what I understand the reasoning was there, and I feel like otherwise the way that case went forward and the procedure of that case seems to be a workable solution until the legislature steps in. I mean, sovereign immunity has clearly been waived under some circumstance, under the procedures of 112. Clearly, it's not the UDGA. We have a long line of cases saying you cannot bring a challenge to a tax assessment in a declaratory judgment action. We have Raytheon E-Systems, we have AutoHaas, we have all of these cases. And also, that would raise the possibility of attorney's fees, which I don't think the state would want raised either. And allowing, you know, this injunction procedure is a stopgap until the legislature deals with the constitutional issue and properly, sets forth procedure would be a workable solution.
Do we have other areas where a deck action can be utilized for one's specific situation as opposed to striking a rule, striking a statute?
I mean, there is some hint in our communications that may have existed at the time of that decision, but I think the recent case law has very clearly delineated what kinds of actions fall under the UDGA and what actions must fall under the procedures of 112.
And there, so would not this be a radical departure to allow it to proceed in this sort of context where it's for one person to basically attack the unique features of their tax, individual tax assessment?
Really, what you're trying to do, though, is just bring a plain old garden variety tax protest suit without having to comply with the prepayment requirement.
Exactly. Just the exact standard injunction and protest suit that anybody does when they prepay, just without the requirement of prepayment.
Yeah.
And so just you know, the simple procedures we're all familiar with, just without this unnecessary payment.
Does the payment that was made have any effect one way or the other, or is this sort of all or nothing? I know the taxpayer paid about $150. Is that something that was, I guess y'all did that voluntarily.
We did.
The trial judge didn't make some finding that they could pay up to this point, and beyond that there was an inability.
We did that voluntarily. I mean, you want me to be honest about what happened? My client thought that they had the ability to pay the whole thing. They were trying to pay it in installments. They ended up, due to their business, not being able to do that. So that's why we ended up proceeding as we did. I mean, certainly we've complied with the protest payment procedures for a portion of it.
And you all asserted 052 and 101 as the basis for your lawsuit?
Yes. I mean, admittedly, we have a sticky situation here. I understand that this is kind of unusual, but it's also unusual to have a situation where a statute has been found unconstitutional for so long, particularly one of such importance and such common use as this one, and you don't have the legislature acting to give taxpayers a clear path to get into court and challenge their assessments. But I think that the whole line of cases make very clear that the Texas Supreme Court and this court do not want there to be two tiers of justice in this state. We don't want people who have money to be able to access the trial court, this court, and potentially the Texas Supreme Court, but people who cannot afford it to be able to be one and done with the administrative procedure. I don't think that it in any way is just and in any way is in the spirit of the Constitution of Texas to have two tiers of justice in this state. And unfortunately, this does require a bit of an awkward circumstance due to legislative inaction. I hope that, you know, any finding procedure set forth here is temporary and that the legislature comes up with a workable solution for the taxpayers of Texas. But until then, I think that under our communications, under law, under Richmond Aviation, under Texas Association of Business, our case must be allowed to proceed. Any other questions?
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd just like to raise a few brief points. Regarding the 108 hearing and the analysis that was done under that, in that ruling, the judge did rule that for them to prepay in this situation would be, for them to be required to prepay in this situation would be an unreasonable restriction on access to courts, but that was strictly in the context of a hearing under 112-108.
How does that differ from the underlying open courts analysis? Isn't that basically a restatement of it? Unreasonable access to the courts? That piece of the open courts analysis?
It is, Your Honor, and that was why in Section 108 the legislature said that that's what is required for the trial court to find. The 108 was amended following our communications to rule to say that if a party files an affidavit of indigency and the court finds that prepayment in this situation would be an unreasonable restriction on the right to access of courts, then they're excused. This hearing was scheduled as a ruling on their oath of inability to pay. It was not a summary judgment on a claim that the statute violates the open courts. It was just with regard to this particular taxpayer, could they or could they not prepay under Section 108. That was the entirety of the hearing. Since this court had already stricken the amended version of Section 108 in Bandag and then verified that in Richmond Aviations, we did not have a full-blown 108 hearing. Both parties had pretty much admitted at that point that Section 108 was gone. And so this was just about whether the taxpayer could pay, not about whether the statute itself, the prepayment requirements themselves, violate the open court's provisions.
Yeah, which at most, in other words, what you've got here is some kind of as-applied type barrier to enforcement. I don't understand them to be facially trying to blow up the whole thing for all people, you know.
I understand them to be doing that, okay. To be saying that, you know, the prepayment requirements themselves violate the open court's provision with respect to everyone, okay. But that hasn't been properly pled. But that is their argument, as I understand it, would be a facial challenge, which has just never been made in a proper form. Hmm. It does not restrict access to courts because it is a waiver of sovereign immunity. You know, in general, sovereign immunity blocks any kind of suit against the state. Here we have sections 101, sections 052, sections 151 that say these people can bring a suit that they otherwise, any taxpayer can bring a suit that it otherwise could not have brought. It just has to prepay first. If that were problematic, then the option would be to strike the waiver of sovereign immunity, because sovereign immunity is the default position. But it's not restricting anyone's access to court. It's granting an access to court that would not otherwise exist. Otherwise, no one could come in and challenge their tax liability. No one would ever have that option. This is what the legislature set up as a limited waiver of sovereign immunity. That's what the legislature intended, is only when there's prepayment can they come in. Even when 108 was amended to provide the affidavit of inability to pay, that was in an effort to save 108 and to prevent declaratory judgments. It's not, this court held in Bandag that 108 can't be picked apart and certain sections enforced and other sections not enforced. So that 108 is gone entirely. So the only way for taxpayers to get in is under a proper 112 claim or a proper UDJA claim or APA challenge or something
like that. And for those parties who could successfully prove up an inability to meet the monetary conditions of 112, their avenue is what?
Unfortunately, they can't file suit because of sovereign immunity. Unless they have a valid constitutional claim or they're challenging the rule, but just to challenge their tax assessment, just to challenge their liability, unfortunately they do not have an avenue for that. And the Supreme Court did rule in our communications that was sufficient just to give them the UDJA, give them the APA, give them ways to come in to challenge egregious acts. That was sufficient to secure their right to open access to courts. As far as the takings claim analysis, I'll happily supply post-submission briefing if you'd like.
Because, I mean, your premise is basically taxpayer has no remedy against what the taxpayer might argue is illegal taxation absent 112, and I just raised the question. I mean, at some point, it seems like you'd have some kind of takings. I'm just wondering how these pieces fit together. Maybe it's historical. You know, we deal with a lot of tax, but not at the depth y'all do. Maybe there's some insight to be found in the history of how this stuff came to be.
Unfortunately, I don't have that off the top of my head, except that it would have to be that property had been taken, and here nothing's been taken. We haven't claimed any money. If there's a collection suit, the taxpayer has various options for bringing claims or asserting defenses in a collection suit. So I'll be happy to look into that and provide additional briefing.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Okay, thank both of you for your helpful argument. The case will be submitted for consideration.